Like at all, but he seems really cool, and so we're both, all of us are about to hear his story. Yeah, so I'm gonna introduce Zach. Come on up, Zach.
Hi, I'm Zach.
Hi, Zach. We love you, Zach. Lots and lots and lots.
How much?
Hot. Hi, everybody. My name's Zach. I have alcoholism. I don't know. I'm just going to introduce myself the way I was always taught. You know, I got a sponsor. His name's Randy. I got a service commitment. I'm the speaker seeker for my home group's Dr. Bob's Nightmare, and I sponsor some people. And literally, that's just a checklist at this point. It's just what I was told to do, you know, when I came in here. And I don't know. It's interesting speaking here. Man, I got sober when I was 16. Like, literally, I grew up in AA. Like, there's no other way. It's not like a metaphor. It's like, literally, I grew up here. And, you know, I was thinking earlier, I didn't really have any fear up until, like, 2 o'clock. And then it got this overwhelming fear, you know, about doing this. And so I kind of did this meditation, and I kind of went back through my life and kind of did this thing where what would happen if I never got sober? And what I started to realize was this, is that I wouldn't have the job I have right now, you know, because the people I work with, I went to rehab with when I was 16, right? I wouldn't have the friendships that I have. I wouldn't be able to do anything like this because I'm completely terrified and I'm super introverted and this stuff is really uncomfortable. You know, I wouldn't be able to do any of this. It just wouldn't have happened. The relationship with my mom would have disappeared. I never would have went to college. I would have just done what I'd done, you know, which was drink in my room and listen to The Cure. That's, you know? Like sometimes we get up here, and I've seen this happen a lot in young people's AA, and always just a bummer, right? It's like, you know, if you're anything like me, I've never fit anywhere my whole life, and when I came here, I felt like I fit, right? But what the ego does to somebody like me when I'm new is it says that I wasn't bad enough, right? I wasn't bad enough, so then what? And I've seen this happen to a lot of people here, where they over embellish because they think their story isn't enough, right? They say things like maybe they say they started shooting dope, but really they didn't, right? And that's really important stuff, right? Because if in my experience, if I don't base the first step on a foundation of truth, I can't do this. I just can't, because there's no truth. It all crumbles, you know? I mean, I don't know. That's just a thought there. But, you know, this last year has been different. This last year has been living with a lot of uncertainty. You know, sometimes we talk a lot about, you know, what it was like, and we refer to the first year. And this year has been full of uncertainty, and I've had to act with trust, which is something I haven't had to do, like, a lot in a long time, you know. I got let go from this printing job, like, it's almost a year ago now, right? And I was like, maybe I'm not supposed to do graphic design anymore. Maybe I'm not supposed to be a designer, right? Maybe getting let go from jobs. I don't know. I'm talking to my sponsor. Maybe art was a bad decision. Maybe I should have never went to school for that. And this is what's going on with me. And so I start kind of filling out these jobs, and I start doing all of that. And, you know, what always happens here starts to happen, you know. Somebody offers me a little bit of work. Another person offers me a little bit of work. And I kind of just live on luck for a little bit, and I just trust. You know, I have a friend that's like, dude, I think you should take these opportunities and just trust and try this. Just keep working and see what happens. And so for like six, 9 months, I do this. I work these jobs. I'm living on like $900 a month. I'm like barely making it, right? But there's something that's happening in this time is that I'm starting to figure out, holy crap, I can work from home and I can do this. And then out comes this wonderful opportunity where I get to start working for my friends. And so I get to wake up every morning and I get to work from home and I get to work with my friend. I mean, my boss walked in earlier, just lit me up, you know. And to be able to work with people I got sober with, man, that's so amazing. And And then again, you know, this keeps happening, right? Where there's this uncertainty, you know, I've had this relationship happen in this, like, last year that's been, that was off and on and was this kind of nightmare, and it felt like I couldn't get out of it. And recently I just started seeing somebody, and I never thought that was gonna happen. You know, a lot of what's happened in Alcoholics Anonymous for me is receiving these things that I never thought was gonna happen. Receiving friendship, like so glad Ethan's here tonight and he's sober. You know what I mean? Like, it wasn't that long ago that we were picking him up from the hospital again. You know, when I wake up and he had got close enough where it just, the tears are starting to roll down. Because we both know, right? And the truth is if you have alcoholism, I don't really think that you actually understand alcoholism until you're on the other side of it, when you're dealing like with somebody else, right? Where you start to realize, oh crap, dude, I'm not just powerless, they're powerless too. And there's nothing that we can do, right? Because often this looks like this thing of like, if you think you're choosing alcohol over your family or over all these things, that hasn't been my experience. My experience is that alcohol takes me. It's my master. It's like it talks about in Bill's story, you know, it owns me. It tells me when I get up in the morning, when I should go to bed at night, who I should be, all of those things. And I don't really have a choice in any of that until, you know, I got here. And this is what happened for me, was that I knew that I couldn't stop to some extent. I didn't know the extent of that, right? I knew that when I drank, I lost all control. And I knew that, and I kind of made these cracks like I was alcoholic. And I realized that pretty early on. I realized that at about 15. At about 15, I realized that my friends drink differently than me. We didn't drink the same, you know? And I ended up getting, you know, I'm a pathetic alcoholic, so I ended up getting citizens arrested, right? I mean, like, I don't even get arrested by the police, right? Like, I mean, like, I'm pathetic, dude. Like, good people just, like, pull into an alley and throw me on the ground and are like, you know, wait till the cops come, dude. Like, that's the kind of alcoholic I am, right? I'm not hard, dude. I'm just a sad little emo kid, you know? It's just truth. And I told, you know, I had this moment where I was like, you know, maybe I really, really have a problem, you know? And so I tell my mom, and luckily my mom had been in Al-Anon a long time. If anyone in Al-Anon here, I love you. Because, you know, what my mom did was she jumped that opportunity. And then when I went to rehab, you know, I thought I overreacted, right? Like, I didn't really need to go to rehab. And that was kind of my thought. And what happened is that I met all of you guys, and I didn't believe you guys when I came here, right? I didn't believe that your life was really better. I honestly thought that you guys were all just getting drunk, really. You know, that's kind of what I thought. And what happened for me was that I really believed in one person. And that person, I didn't work the steps right off the bat. You know, 4 months in, I found somebody. And I think if you have real alcoholism and you don't do the steps, this is what happens, right? Is that you get worse, right? You don't get better if you're like me. You get worse. No alcohol, me being sober, that sounds like hell, right? That's why I didn't want to get sober, is because when I'm sober, it's awful. It feels like I'm coming apart at the seams. My head is crazy. My emotions are all over the place. I don't know what to do. You know, and I do things like this where I try to outrun myself. I try to outrun myself through music, through girls, through whatever it is, right? I just constantly am trying to outrun myself, and I think that if I'm in this relationship, I'll be happy. And I do this sober, too. Like, let's be real about this, right? I think that if I buy this car, I'll be happy. I think that if I do this, I'll be happy. And what happens is none of that ever makes me happy, right? I just end up more miserable. And that's happened to me here, where I've gotten more miserable here trying to get all of the things, you know, and what I found is that the peace is in here. And so I'm not going to say much more, but I will say this. Recently there's been a sort of a line that I've used as a mantra, and it's, I mean, big shocker if you know me, it's from a poem, right? It's just who I am, whatever, you know. And it's from Annie Sexton's poem, Courage. And I don't know if you've ever heard it, but I'll say the beginning of it. She says, in the small things we see it, in the baby's first step, as awesome as an earthquake. And in what she's saying in this poem is that courage isn't in the big act. It's in the little one. And that's been my experience here. It's when the newcomer picks up his first chip. You know what I'm saying? And it's so paradoxical for that person because we tell them we love you, right? You've gone and screwed your life up and we say, we love you, man, right? It's the first time you make amends with everything in you telling you to turn the car around and not do it, right? It's telling your sponsor the thing that you're too afraid to tell them. That's been my experience of what courage looks like. It looks like making the coffee when you don't want to, you know? It's very easy to see who's willing here because it's in their feet, right? And often we talk about willingness as if it's this feeling, and it's never been like that, dude. I've never wanted to make amends without bad motive, right? That's just the truth, right? Until I did this long enough where sometimes, right, sometimes I'm willing to do the things I don't want to do because I have a little bit of experience. And when I say sometimes, I'm talking like 5% of the time. You know, still, when things come up, I struggle to call my sponsor, right? I have a friend, Jacob, who says this, and it's so powerful, where he talks about when he starts his share, he always says the things that he isn't doing well. He says, I haven't been praying that much lately. My meditation's bad. And I think when we're able to be current and to be honest with where I am with the steps now, that's where the power happens. Because if I lead with a lie, I can't get better. And for me, this is an active practice. I got to live this. You know, this is for me. I don't know how it is for you, right? But for me, this is a way of life. And when taken as a way of life, my life is good. And with that, I'll shut up.
Okay, he's gonna start over. No, he's not. No, no, he's not. He's gonna go to his room and listen to The Cure. That was awesome. Party in his room. Just kidding. No, no, that really happens. I'm not condoning that. There's not really a party in his room. So thank you. That was amazing. Let's give him another round of applause. So I've known Jenny Lee for quite some time, and I literally stay awake at night thinking about how I want to introduce her, and I realized that she is a woman that needs no introduction. So here's Jenny Lee.
Speak into the mic.
That's a long ways down there. You guys hear me okay? Okay. I thought you drank The Cure. I thought that was the deal. That tells you how old I am. My name is Jenny, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi, Jenny. We love you, Jenny. Lots and lots and lots.
How much?
Oh.
Wow, is that
powerful.
Is that ever powerful? I don't need to go to therapy anymore. Thank you. I want to qualify really quickly. Are any of our singers or drummers still here? Okay, is our elder still here? Okay, because I'm going to drop the F-bomb.
Do it!
And I don't want to do it in front of her. So this takes a lot of work. And this was absolutely beautiful. I have a group that I sing with, not as a singer, but that I pray with. And it was an honor to be able to stand in your circle this evening, so thank you for that. Also want to point out that we have an interpreter on board, and this is not easy either, and thank you. Yeah. So with that said, well done, conference folks, all you guys that have done all this work that look like deer in the headlights right now. Man, it's an honor to be here this evening. I am shaking in my moccasins. It's okay, I can do that. You know, I got sober on April 5th, 1989. There's a statement about a survey that was done in 1989. Nobody asked me shit. But I was definitely one of the, I was somewhere between the three and I think it was the 26%. I was 26 years old when I got to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was not a choice I made on my own. To wind it back a little bit, I'm gonna qualify with my parents and a little bit of my drug use. It's part of my qualifying story. So mom and dad were busy, they were successful, and they were not necessarily present, but they were never cool that I recall. I love both of my parents very, very dearly. The place I think where we missed the boat in my family was they were successful. Both of them were very successful business people, and they worked together. So every time a deal came through, they both had that success pride. And what came of that in regard, I was the third child, and I came along a lot later. My mom was 45 when I was born. And what came of that for me behaviorally was my folks threw money at every problem I had. My sister was also in law enforcement, so I never had to spend any well-deserved days in juvenile hall. So I learned how to squawk, get money, get car keys, continue with my behavior, and quite frankly, I was, as many of us have grown to know, selfish, self-centered, and egotistical. And don't you know who I am? And believe me, I use that line to get out of a lot of shit. Don't you know who I am? My mom is, my sister is so-and-so. She's your training officer. Don't you know? Yeah. Unfortunately, it worked at the time, but unfortunately the long-term piece of that was that shit doesn't work as an adult. And reality started hitting pretty hard. So I started drinking and drugging around the age of 14, 15 years old. And guess who was buying my weed for me, right? Mom and dad. I'd never finished high school. I was one of those folks that GED'd and went into the military. I am a veteran. I am extremely proud of that fact. Unfortunately, I did not stay sober long enough to enjoy the pride that comes with wearing the uniform for very long. But later in the story, we'll get to where that has come full circle for me. My drunkalog is probably like everybody else's, but there's a drug piece in there where my first bottom was. I was living in a tent in California outside of Santee. Anybody know Santee, California? I am so fucking glad you got out alive. living in a tent out there, and before I knew it, I was addicted to heroin. It was not a long run of heroin. It was very short, but it was enough to be the first awakening for me. The gentleman that I was with at the time decided it was time to get out of California. I'd committed a couple of felonies, hadn't got caught yet, time to go. And we ended up heading to Sturgis. The thing was, I made it as far as Ash Fork. And back those days, the I-40 did not go around Ash Fork. The old Highway 66 is what we took to get into Flagstaff. And they were building the bridges. And I spent a week under the bridges, under one of the bridges, with a gallon of water and nothing else, detoxing from heroin. And some of you know the symptoms of this. We'll get to that. By the time I got to my mother's house, she lives in Flagstaff, or lived in Flagstaff. And again, my folks were wealthy, lived in the upscale part of Flagstaff, Arizona. By the time we got there, it was a horrifying scene. I can't imagine what could have possibly gone through her head at that time when I got off that motorcycle. Now, this conference is about matters of the heart. This was a matter of me breaking my mother's heart. That woman, with every ounce of dignity she could stir in herself, stood in the front yard with a hose over my head, hosing shit out of my hair so I could get clean enough to get into her bathroom and take a proper shower. The pain I put that woman through my addiction. Now, she gets to own part of that. She was, you know, the queen of codependency. That's where I got my crown from. But the fact of the matter is, I took her through the gates of hell with me. So that was my first bottom. Back out, I ended up going to Colorado, got my nursing license, life was happening, and the bottle became my dictator. I don't even remember why I left Colorado. Something happened. Probably drank my mortgage payment or something and had to leave. But I left, went back to Flagstaff, moved into my mother's house, and started working at a detox. Oh, yeah. Right? My truth became glaringly real for me. During that short period of time, I think it was about 6 months, while I was working in the detox, I woke up in four-point restraints in the very same building that I worked in. I didn't have a job after that. They didn't care for my behavior, and neither did I, frankly. Wow, I just zoned completely out. Ride to alcohol, to the bottom of my alcohol addiction, ensued shortly thereafter. I had a little tiny, everybody likes this story for some reason. I had this little tiny apartment. And I also had a severe drinking problem and a gun problem. Yeah. The only place I know of in the country where you can buy your booze and your guns and your ammo in the same store happens to be in Flagstaff. So, Ruff's Liquor. Did I hear Ruff's Liquor back there? Yeah! I don't think they're doing that shit anymore. So, anyway, in my inebriation, there are two things that occurred in that house that really, looking back on it, as I was beginning my step work, kind of shook me up. One of them was I owed about $800 on my Triumph Spitfire at the time, and instead of going to the bank and paying the bank the money that I owed them, I decided that I was going to disassemble the entire car and hide it in my house. Everything but the frame. He's back there. Everything but the frame went in. And, you know, I'm sure the repo guys knew where it was. I'm sure the bank knew where it was. I was the only one that thought it was a good idea. The other thing that happened was because of the guns, I had a really bad habit of shooting a box of apples that was in my house. Well, when it was all said and done, after about 2 weeks of this, I had applesauce in my kitchen, all over everything, and a hole that led to the outside of the place I was living in, about that big. It's still cold in April in Flagstaff. So, you know, some glaring red flags in terms of behavior. And my neighbors were terrified of me. Go figure. So during that time, I had stopped nursing. I started turning wrenches at Sinclair. Anybody know Sinclair up in Flagstaff? I was the crazy blonde that worked at Sinclair that busted tires for a living. And the reason I took that job is it facilitated my drinking. And I quickly drank myself into acute alcohol poisoning. I spent 3 days in Flagstaff Medical Center getting ready to go to detox. I drugged my mother through that hell once again. Now what happened, and I will try to do this without crying, please understand, my mother is, she's my person. What happened was, Mom, I fell off the grid for a little while. Mom showed up at my house, and she found me curled up around the engine of that Triumph Spitfire in what was left of a bed. It was more like a futon. And I was dope sick, or I was alcohol sick. Take a pick. The first thing that she thought of doing was giving me imipramine, which is a psychiatric medication. They use it for ADHD and some other things, and it's a stimulant. The doctors told her, after they finally got me to the hospital, that had she not put that imipramine in my mouth and forced me to swallow it, that my heart would have stopped beating on the way. This is the hell that I put my person in. So that was the drinking. That's what got me here. When I was got out of detox, went into rehab, I did a 28-day spin dry. I was fucking terrified. I didn't know how to do anything but drink and take, and drink and take, and drink and expect more. The movement into recovery, I to be honest with you, I don't remember a whole lot of pieces about this. I was in a fog for about 5 years. Sometimes I wonder if I'm still in that fog, but there were some highlights that come out, and this really highlights alcoholic thinking that Jenny operates with. I know Amber loves this story. Got out of treatment, thought I had my shit in a bag and I was just gonna go do this thing. So I moved out into the middle of nowhere in the woods, and I was living in a little, somebody's nodding back there going. So living in a little A-frame, and winter was coming, and I had a little Pinto. Who remembers a Pinto? Anybody in here remember a Pinto? I had a Pinto motor, four cylinder, that was my generator for power in the house. And I went out to cut wood one day, you know, because I got my shit together, right? And I'm out there cutting wood, and long, crazy blonde hair, wild looking, it was down to my butt. No shirt, pair of Levi's, logging boots, a .357, and a large Husqvarna chainsaw. And my sponsor's still shaking her head. She's here. I do have a sponsor. And I do sponsor. So I'm out cutting wood, and I hear this, hey! And I turn around with a very large chainsaw and a very large gun, and I scream at three hunters that I just terrified. Three armed men turned around and ran away, screaming shit the whole way as they're running out of this little place with the community that I lived in. And that was an awakening moment for me, because I realized that I was still creating havoc in my life. I was still creating a wake of destruction. I was still terrifying people. And I put my stuff up and I packed my shit and I moved back into town with my mom, back into my old bedroom at the age of 26. And I'm glad I did that. I was able to get busy on the steps. Now, I've had how long to think about this?
Months
to think about it. You know, that step one was pretty easy considering I was terrified. I knew that if I drank again, I would die. I had proven that to myself already. I didn't even want to test the waters. It was a second time around for me. I'm not one of those people that gets it the first time. I got to try it, break it. But that time I knew that if I drank again, I would die. The second step was kind of like the fuck you talking about? As you can see, I, by the grace of Creator, have been able to move past that. I did find something that was bigger and badder and stronger than me and all my dad's development equipment, and that was a mountain. So I turned my attention to the mountain, the San Francisco Peaks, and that became my higher power. Shortly thereafter, I was turned on to the Sweat Lodge. And I'm qualified, right? Right? So at that time, I'm going to talk to you for a minute. At that time, I had started praying for the invitation to ceremony. 28 years later, that invitation came. And there were some preceding factors to that invitation coming. But I can assure you that I can't think of any place that I would rather be than on the Red Road. Who? Yeah. My family is there, my other family. I have the AA family and I have my Red Road family. My Toroshmi. So 28 years asking for that. The fourth step, my sponsor was amazing. She was actually brilliant. She knew that I needed props, right? So this fucking bitch asked me. As a matter of fact, she's supposed to be here. Merritt, are you here? No? Okay. She asked me to pick up a rock for every resentment on that first list. She had me do it right out of the book. She didn't tell me make them little ones. She didn't tell me that I would be carrying them with me on my motorcycle everywhere that I went. She didn't tell me that I would be showering with them and that they would go to meetings with me. So I had this bandana tied up with rocks inside of it. Set it down on the table and then go get my coffee. When we did my fifth step, we went through each and every one of those stones. We were out in Sedona, and she had me throw those stones over the cliff. Because I need pictures. I think in pictures. I'm not like you data folks. Don't get it. And when we were done, we processed each and every one. There's two things I walked out of there with. There was compassion and ownership. Ownership for my behavior and compassion for those people that were on my list. It took a little while for the idea to solidify inside of me that we do what we do to keep ourselves safe. I do what I do to keep myself safe. So those folks were just responding to my stuff. The other thing she did is she said, now that you've thrown them all off the cliff there, if you ever want them back, go get them. That showed me that there was futility in going backwards. There was nowhere for me to go at that point but forwards. So it was a powerful fist step for me. And then I got to ride, did the 6 and 7 right there. Actually, I'm going to stop real quick. Agape love also became something that I was aware of. Agape love is a greater love. It's love for people that we may not interact with, things that we may not have direct or indirect impact on or with. And I was laying on this rock, and I'm watching an airliner fly over, and I realized that airplane was full of people. Some of them were going home to get married. Some were going home to maybe be with a loved one who was having a baby. Some were going home to bury family members. Some were military members leaving home, young, and out of their element. Some were just working, and it was another day in the park. But I realized there's all kinds of different things going on, and I had a deep, deep sense of connection with a plane full of people who I would never, ever make eye contact with. And that moved me into another level of understanding of this thing that we talk about in the rooms of love. I think it set me up to be able to love another alcoholic or addict, regardless of their behavior. So that was my fifth step experience. Did the 6 and 7, rode home on my motorcycle. Love my bikes. So I spent another year in Flag. We didn't have this, by the way. The old timers and Flagstaff used to tell us to pack our tents and stuff, and they'd haul us our asses up to Lake Powell and make us water ski. It was awful. Lake Powell's my second home. So we didn't, we didn't have this significant young people's community, but we did have a small contingency of folks. And we would literally take over Lone Rock Beach. One of the beauties of that particular summer event that we did, it wasn't even an event, just Flagstaff AA would just move to Lake Powell for a week. But we had a gentleman come back, I don't remember which year it was, but we had a gentleman come back the following year. He was drunk, wanting to know why we were having way more fun than they were. And he came back the next year sober. And he moved his camp from the back up to the beach, and we suddenly had a new member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the message of Alcoholics Anonymous was carried inadvertently. Not even inadvertently, it was carried by grace, I guess. So you never know. I'd be willing to bet a $20 bill that there's somebody in this hotel that's gonna see what we got going on here. At least think about it. Think about a change. And that means you and I have all earned our keep. Seeds. What was I, 6? Step 7 was humbly asking him, I don't have that capacity, or at least I didn't at the time. I sometimes wonder. The there's a story that comes up, and I don't know that my sponsor even knows this, but I'm going to go ahead and tell it. And it actually has more to do with 8 and 9. But there's a huge step 7 component in this. That when I was in high school, I slept with my best friend's brand new husband. Yeah, fucking attractive, right? So I didn't really carry that because it hadn't hit my radar as something to care about until I got here. And I ran into her brother at an event about 3-4 years ago, and he comes running across the parking lot. Oh, so-and-so's just gonna love to hear from you. Now, this is a woman that was on my amends list. The getting to that place where I could make an amends, an emotional, heartfelt amends from my heart to her heart, I got there through step 7. The thing was, it was not an option for me to go into her life and blow it up. And I had to make up my mind in that moment, okay, if she brings it up, I get to own it. Lock, stock, and barrel. And if she doesn't, I get to treat her with dignity and respect and love her no matter what. She didn't bring it up and I didn't blow her life up. So having had an opportunity to sit with this for a while, I learned about this thing called, well, I learned about it a long time ago, but it really became a huge part of my walk today, that I can make an amends to the universe. And the amending part is, I don't get to re-perpetrate that crime, ever. I do not get to re-perpetrate that crime. If I do, then I've committed the worst crime against myself that I can think of. So that moves me into that whole self-respect thing. How much time?
You're good.
I'm good? The maintenance steps, I wasn't real practiced, to be honest with you. Fortunately, I had sponsors who would throw the steps at me. You need to do this. Wake it up. What we did, well, I say what we did, it was actually my decision, but I felt the need to ramp up my step work a little bit. Now, I was talking about being a veteran earlier. I am blessed with the most amazing job in the world. I get to work with chemically dependent and PTSD suffering veterans. And I could not do that had I not signed up, even though I drank myself and had some other issues coming out of the military. It has given me the opportunity to do work that I absolutely love. And in seeing that, I teach 12-step concepts, go figure. It came to me that if I work my steps, step 1 all January, every day, step 2 all of February, step 3 all of March, see what happens. So in a nutshell, what's happened is, not only am I powerless over alcohol, I'm powerless over you guys, and her, and him, my boss. I'm sure there's folks in the room going, yeah, we get that. What happened in working that step every day is it brought it down to a cellular level for me. So when I moved to that second step, that became a cellular level. And what I did is I meditated every morning on those steps. After I got past step 4, I kind of ended up back in step 11. which is fine. I'm okay with working on step 11 every day for the rest of this year. I'm good with that. Because what I found in the process of the first 4 or 5 is that I can't even describe it. It's moved it into a place in my chest that I thought only you lived in, that you lived in. It's broadened my capacity to love. Absolutely. When it comes to making amends, I found out on that step 5, meditating on it every day, I found that usually, because I've worked on my behavior quite a bit, but usually the one who needed the amends, the one that I needed to apologize and get real with, was the woman who was putting on her work face and walking into an absolutely heartbreaking situation and trying to be okay in that. Once I realized that, my effectiveness in my work became tenfold. I know that everybody that I work with has a real strong message of Alcoholics Anonymous and a real strong message of love. And when I go home at night, I'm going to steal this line from a young man that stood at a podium about 6 years ago. He said, the softest pillow he'd ever laid his head upon was that of a clean conscience. After doing this work, I know that I'm doing my best every day. I'm carrying the message of recovery. I'm carrying the message of hope. That's, I don't know, where am I at now? How many?
You can wrap it up.
I can wrap it up? Okay. I will share real briefly, who's familiar with the third edition of the Book of Alcoholics Anonymous? Okay. There's a handful of us in here that got sober in that third edition. And I share this because it was the paragraph in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous that saved my life, and I could comprehend, I could get my head and my heart around it. And quite frankly, that paragraph has come absolutely full circle in my recovery today. And I'm going to paraphrase this. AA is a synthesis of all the philosophy I've ever read. All of it based on love, and that there is only one law, the law of love, and there is only two sins. One is to stand in the way of another human being's growth, and the other is to stand in one's own way. It took me a little while to get out of my own way, but I'm really grateful I have. I can't thank you guys enough for supporting my recovery today, and I am so deeply touched and stoked at all the young faces in here. Oh, you know what? I forgot Mom. A year after I got sober, my mother came into the rooms. She was 1 year and 1 day behind me in CHIPS. She died just shy of her 25th sobriety birthday. Yeah, let's do it. I was 26 when I got here. She was 76 when she got here. My mom and I had the privilege, the honor, and the love to be raised in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous together. That is something I can't even begin to describe to you. I was with her on her passing. I've lost both of my parents here, by the way. And I've yet found a reason to drink. And if one was going to be, it was going to be the loss of my mom. with that crazy, crotchety old woman who I love dearly put fuel into my recovery. And I think she gave me the strength and the ability to get up here and look at all of you and just stand in awe. Her recovery was beautiful. She played a beautiful part in mine. And now, I'm done. Thanks for supporting my recovery today.